Sandy, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John Mack Mullen, John Mack the Sum. Welcome to the 231st episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 230 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at the web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. This month, as I keep repeating on the show, is National Poetry Month. And we actually began our celebration of the month 2 weeks early with Alan Kleinman, an attorney-turned poet under the name of Ace Mulvihill. And tonight, as you will hear, we will have still another poet as we move toward the end of the month. Next week, on April 29th, we will conclude the celebration, but not our interest in poetry, with poet and activist Rosie Duffy. The commercial item relating to poetry, my latest book, Live at the Freight House, is now available on Amazon in both paperback and Kindle formats. But it's a collection of both the poems that I read that February of this year when I was the featured poet at the Old Putt at the historic Freight House in Mayapack, New York, and also contains poems read by local poets, Carol D'Amato, Vincent Bell, L.C., the pseudonym, Terry Dugan, John Caprielian, Tony Pena, and Bob Zaslow during the open mic portion of the program. Less than a month from today, on Friday, May 18th, I will host the Poets Gala at the same Freight House, headlined by Robin Milby, poet laureate of Orange County, New York, and Ralph Nazareth, coordinator of the legendary weekly Tuesdays at Curly's, poets gathering in Stamford, Connecticut. Of contributors to the book will also speak briefly and join me in signing copies. The contributors will have the chance to speak longer on the following Sunday, May 20th, right here, where I host an on-air reunion. Tune in to see if I can deal with 7 simultaneous guests. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 231st in the series. My guest is poet and author, who was the Pulitzer Prize winner in a previous incarnation, as reported with the New York Times. And Kelly is spelled K-E-L-L-E-Y. The listeners wishing to join Tina and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. Once again, that's 646-716-9756. And I normally hold callers until near the end of my conversation with my guest. So let's get going. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you start us off with the poem?
Sure, I'd love to. This is a poem from my second book, which is called Precise. The poem is called To Yahweh, and it has a epigraph from a book called The Gifts of the Jews by Thomas Cahill. The epigraph reads, Yahweh is definitely a verb form. We can take comfort in the certain knowledge that God is a verb, not a noun or an adjective. So when I read that in the book, I was amazed and delighted and ran off to write a poem about the idea of God being a verb. It's called To Yahweh. God is the spray on your lip from the freshly poured ginger ale. No, God is the arrival on your lip of the spray, the arcing, the spree. God is definitely not that weird sexuality of wild bird rehabilitators. God is, instead, waves blown back hard from the shore at night. Perhaps he is the rumbling scaring done by the haunted freight train, the shrill ghouls in the back cars climbing over each other to escape. God is weequashing, the spearing of eels or fish from a canoe by torchlight. God is the inventing of words like weequashing. She is not the fire darkening down. She is the goldfinch singing the whisper song. And the birthing of a second child, to feel your body blooming, to feel head, then shoulders, thighs, then cord tumbling, to live, to life, to give the initial downbeat to the timpani, to cure mice by placing them in a cello, to do whatever the scarecrow did with his brains, and to make that acrid or burned quality of the smell of space, to crow, to fly, to gild and gnaw, to mean, shape, shear, smear and shine, play and improvise, to last.
That's terrific. And it's interesting when you mentioned the birthing. The minister at church this morning, a woman who owns horses with her husband, talks about the miracle of seeing an animal born, and talks about shepherd and everything. It's interesting.
Thank you.
Where'd you grow up? Didn't go to early school.
I grew up in Morristown, New Jersey. I went to elementary school there at Woodland and George Washington and Lafayette, and then went to Mendham High School for high school, and went to Yale for to get my English degree.
Boy, you're way ahead of me.
Do
you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
I wanted to be a writer since I was in second grade. I was very lucky to know pretty much all my life that was what I wanted to do, and luckily still want to do. I saw a slideshow about Walt Kelly and his pogos, you know, his comic strip about pogo, and I thought it was wonderful to write stories, and I wanted to do that.
It's interesting. I came to poetry late, even though I was an English major. I was a technologist for years, and my daughter was a advertising executive at Times, and in her late 30s, she became a physical trainer and a coach. But my son knew from when he was 12 years old, he was going to be a screenwriter, and is. And I was just one, you know, and I'm not sure. Some people have the focus early, and other people kind of meander till they get where they belong, I guess.
Yeah, I was lucky. I had a teacher who encouraged me when I was when I wrote my first poems, and perhaps if she'd encouraged me in doing artwork or some other field, I would have gone that way. But it was a lot of good praise coming when I did some writing. So I think I just kept going.
Did you write for your school paper or
yes.
Literary journal?
Yes, both.
And you majored in English at Yale. Did you write for the paper or any literary journals there?
Yeah, I wrote for the news magazine, and I edited it, and I also was on the staff of one of the literary magazines.
My oldest friend, Kevin Buckley, was the editor of the Yale Daily News when he was there back in the, well, I guess it's the late 50s. the late 50s. He was the first Buckley to be the editor after William F. Buckley, who was a good deal before that.
Right.
So, and then he wound up as the as Newsweek's Vietnam correspondent during the war. So
wow.
He had an interesting life. And then what came after college? You didn't immediately get into writing, did you?
No, I worked for Metropolitan Life Foundation for a year and a half, doing corporate philanthropy, and then I went to work for one of their grantees, which was the Educational Priorities Panel that was trying to fix up the New York City public schools through investigative reporting and a coalition of child advocates trying to make policies more sensible and just for children.
Yeah, that was it difficult for you if you were chomping at the bit to be a writer, or did you just settle into it and enjoy it?
It was a lot of writing, so I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It was almost like journalism in that we would write reports, and then very often reporters from the Times would write stories using the information that we'd come up with. So I worked with a brilliant bunch of strategists, and it was very much like journalism.
Before we get into your actual journalism career, how about Den of the Poem?
Oh, sure. This one is from Ardor. It is the first chapbook I've ever done, and it won the chapbook prize last year from JCAR Press. So this is sort of a...
I ordered it today.
Oh, great, great. This is sort of a spring-like poem called The Novice Insomniac to the Crescent Moon, and it's about birds. No more four inside-out mouths inconsolable. They've stopped, so I start my coronation anthem to the future, wedding song for moon and shadow, slimmest sky claw, lid of tight sleeper, more regal than dawn. The others toss their riffs over sunrise with the smug pride of early risers, vexited by a mere day. My bright curve, my egg crack, heralds a month. I must coax it in with vigor over pornographic peonies, over other proofs that the known is never flat, but shaped like song, spreading in resonant dusk, as we, the musically insane, scribble our songs over the yard. So future, come quick, bring warm branches, shifting swarms, sturdy fledglings, soft landings, rain, soaring. I sing until I sleep mid-note, no reason to pause forever.
The musically insane, I like that, that line.
Thank you.
In your... At some point, though, you went off into journalism, and as with many writers, it took you a long time, over 7 years, to get back home to New York. Take us through, A, how did you decide to make the step to go to Philadelphia, and then take us through your career and to get up to the Times?
Oh, okay. Well, I was actually married to a medical student at University of Pennsylvania, and so it made sense to be in Philadelphia. And I was able to get hired by the Philadelphia Inquirer, even though I had spelled Inquirer wrong in my cover letter, which is mortifying. I don't know why they hired me. And I worked there, I guess, for 3.5 years, and then took a job briefly in Quincy, Mass., lived in Somerville, Massachusetts, and it was a staff job at a smaller paper. The first job I had at the Inquirer was as a stringer. So then I went to Seattle, where I worked at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and at the Seattle Times, And then I was freelancing quite a bit and ended up freelancing regularly for the New York Times from Seattle, and then got hired as a staffer in 1999.
And after being there for just a few years, you got brought in into the coverage of 9/11, I guess.
Yes.
How did you?
Well, I was on maternity leave, actually, at the time, in September, and I worked the first week after, just, you know, running around covering whatever there was to cover. But when I came back from maternity leave in December, I was able to do Portraits of Grief. I was working the night shift, so if there was breaking news, I had to do that. But whenever there wasn't breaking news, I would be calling the relatives of people who were lost in 9/11 and writing about 250-word short slices of life about them, trying to bring out what their relatives felt was most important to remember about them. And it was probably the biggest honor I ever had in journalism to do that work, because so much depended on getting it right. For a lot of folks, this was the only time they would be in the newspaper of record, and it was a challenge to differentiate the folks, because there were so many firemen, there were so many people who had worked as bond traders. You know, there was a great similarity in the professions. So there was this obligation to make each one an individual and each one shine. So it was many phone calls and a lot of cutting down of interesting material because we had such limited space for each person. But I think my training as a poet and being terse and spare with language was very useful in that job. I did 121 profiles of the victims, and although I wasn't the one who did the most, there were people who had done more. I worked on it for basically 2 years, because even after the book came out, there was an effort to keep going until we could get every last person who wanted to, whose relatives wanted them in the paper.
The younger brother of one of my closest friends, Bertha Cantor Fitzgerald, Jonathan Connors, and he was the people that died in. And by coincidence, his brother, my friend, was an attorney who gave some of his time to be the lawyer volunteers to the family and everything. So it was a tragic time. How many people were involved in the Pulitzer Prize?
It was a staff Pulitzer Prize, so I always have to put that asterisk when someone says I've won a Pulitzer. I won a staff Pulitzer with the Metro staff. Everyone who was working on any 9/11 material was included in that Pulitzer. I know at least one of my portraits was in the packet that they sent in, and it was definitely a giant group effort.
While at the Times, you also published your first book of poetry, didn't you, The Gospel of Galore,
yes.
In 2003.
Yes.
And you
that
know...
Was, go ahead.
Go ahead.
That was my first book, and it won the Washington State Book Award, which was a giant thrill.
I saw that. Now... As you mentioned earlier, you had started writing poetry in the second grade. Why did it take you so long to attempt to publish poetry?
I started publishing individual poems when I was a teenager. One of the biggest thrills in my life was to get one in Seventeen magazine, and I had just collected over the years the ones that were good enough to be in a poetry collection, and I'd sent it out for probably several years before it got accepted. But some of the poems go actually back to college, not necessarily in that collection, but in some of the later collections. I have ones that I like that I've written recently, but also, you know, several that were written when I was half the age I am now.
Wow. So there's an accumulation. So do you have enough for another collection beyond what you've already published then?
I do. I'm working on it. I'm having some friends look at it to see if it's, you know, if the poems are in the right order. But usually it's about 50 in a collection. And one of my friends says, you know, you have to be proud of the whole thing before you send it out. So at this point, I think I'm proud of the poems, but I'm not necessarily proud of the order they're in. So I'm getting closer.
Yeah, it's funny. I had the poet that I had done last week, his poetry, his first book, it's in alphabetical order. And I said, how did you happen to do that when most of us have it, we group it by theme or by chronology or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's just the way it seemed to make sense to him, that most of his poems deal with the surrounding to him, his way of looking at life. So he thinks they're all the common themes, I might as well do it alphabetically, which is the only thing I've ever seen like that. Have you ever seen anything
new
that goes alphabetically?
Never.
No.
I tried reading this recent one in the order the poems were written, but it didn't work for me. I needed to have my strongest ones first, although my friend who's reading it says I should put my saddest ones first, and I'm mulling that over.
Yeah, I'm trying to put together another collection. There's going to be a whole section on my anti-Trump related poems, and it's interesting because I found some experimental stuff. Like, I never had any interest, or it didn't make any sense to me when people told me about one sentence poems. Well, I wrote one about that, and then on Facebook, there's a group called 3 words per line, and you can't have more than 3 words in the line, and the line can't wrap to the next the same. And it's extremely interesting. And I've been fooling around. I wound up doing 3 about him and Stormy. So it's interesting to come up with these different ways that people write, as well as the people whose actual text on the page it resembles things like Christmas trees or whatever that they're writing about,
which
I've never attempted to do. Have you done any of that?
No, I haven't. I've had some that sort of weave across the page. One that was about wind, but that was about as close as I got to being concrete. I know they have a. I think there's a website of one-sentence poems. I was looking at it actually last week,
but
I didn't get very far into it. But one of my poetry workshop groups was talking about it just on Monday.
Another very, very good site, and it's both on Facebook and the website, is the Poetry Superhighway. Have you done anything with that?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
It's the Poetry Superhighway, and they have all sorts of people contributing, and they pick 2 poets per week to be their featured poets, and they wind up with posting them on the page and promoting them. And I was on with a very interesting poet from North Carolina, the woman who I wound up having on the show about a month ago. So it's it's a good way to meet people that are, you know, from around the country who are into the same genre that we are, hopefully, you know. So
right.
It seems after talking about this that it's a good time to break through the poem. Is that okay?
Sure. I love reading my poems. I am going to read one from Gospel of Galore, the first one. I'm quite smitten and have always been quite smitten with whatever dog I have at the moment. This one was on a Labrador retriever that my husband and I owned and who's no longer with us, but I think it could apply to my current dog as well, and I like to read this one at readings. It's called Now That My Dog's Human. For years, she had pulled on my attention, undeveloped film waiting in a camera. Now Addie is a lively second-grade teacher who drives a red pickup. She puts her whole self in, puts her whole self out. She has those same eyes, like my dead uncle's, almost Welsh, upward turning, beseeching, worried, watching a muddy sea, considerate. We're easy together. We have the loose fit of second-day socks. I'm big sister, not boss. I taught her the geography of a bubble bath, the plain joy of getting clean in the morning. She taught me to eat faster, lie on the sunny part of the rug, approach sleeping strangers in the park. She won't renounce the taste of tennis ball. She's lost her otherness, most of it. It fell off easy like a ripe berry. She catches peanuts in her mouth expertly. And I ask her, what did I do in those electric foot dreams? And what was she thinking when she came when I called, all hunkered down and avid? Her ears still perk up at the tiny click of my smile.
That's terrific. I have a dog. I had to give up when I was 5 and a half because I'm terribly allergic to dogs. And it turned, and I never realized it until about 9 years ago, that I can have the kind of dogs that don't shed, the ones that you have to the money to groom them. And we have the Silky Terrier, a rescue from South Carolina, who runs the house. There's two cats in the house. They all just kind of ignore each other. But she's terrific. She just wonderful.
They're the best.
But she's taken over. And now to your post-Times life. Tell us about that.
Well, in 2009, I took the buyout. There had been a number of buyouts where the staff was needing to shrink at the Times, and everyone needed a plan B. We all were talking about, what would we do if we weren't working there. And I called around to some of the folks I'd worked with in the nonprofit world and spoke with a person I'd written quite a bit about when he was head of child welfare in New Jersey. His name is Kevin Ryan, and he's the head of Covenant House International, which works with homeless and trafficked young people. I had volunteered there when I was right out of college and had thought very highly of him when he was in charge of the foster care system in New Jersey. And I asked him if he knew of anyone who needed a writer in the nonprofit world, and he said he did. He wanted to write a book of stories of transformation of the young people that he had worked with at Covenant House over the years. So I went to work at Covenant House and co-wrote the book with him. It's called Almost Home, Helping Kids Move from Homelessness to Hope. And it was so much fun, such a passion project, such a mission of mine, because I love the work that they do getting kids safe and directed into ways that they can create their own lives after great disappointments. And I was honored to write the book. Cory Booker wrote the foreword to it, and we were able to talk about it on TV once with him. So it was just a wonderful experience, and I spent several years kind of doing a goodwill tour with the book and with Kevin to various places that wanted speakers, including a dozen or so colleges where it was chosen as the freshman year book or the campus-wide read. So I still do articles for them on occasion, and now I'm working on book projects of my own and with other people, and also as a freelance magazine writer.
I seem to remember that Covenant House took a fairly heavy financial hit when the accusations about Father Bruce Ritter came out. Are they whole now? Did they get everything back together again?
You know, they hired a nun to Sister Mary Rose McGeady to take the reins after Father Bruce Ritter left, and she actually brought them back up to where they had been financially within not too many years. She was a force of nature, and she answered letters personally to some of the donors who had felt betrayed by what happened. And she opened a large number of other covenant houses in other cities and countries and was able to regain the trust of donors and foundations and homeless kids. And she did a wonderful job in recouping from that difficult time.
That's good, anyhow.
Yeah.
And a year after the book on homeless children, you published another book of poetry, Precise, ten years after The Gospel Galore, which, as you mentioned, won the Washington State Book Award. What took so long this time? A very similar question to what I asked earlier.
Oh, I don't know how long it's supposed to take between poetry books. I just sort of waited until I had enough that I was proud of and sent it out for a couple of years and ended up with WordTech Communications, which had published my first book as well. And they do a beautiful job with the covers and the layout. And they also have a very high quality stable of poets. Every time I've read with them at writers' conferences or in the city in New York, I've been really impressed with my press mates there. So that came out when it was ready, and I was, you know, happy to see it hit the light of day.
Do you have another poem handy?
I do. I have them all sitting here. So let me read one that was kind of inspired by writing Portraits of Grief. A lot of my poems were influenced by my work as a journalist, and this is one of them for sure. I feel like the world has a better imagination than I do, and if I just take notes on what I see and put those notes all in one place, sometimes it ends up being poetic just because it's real life. Almost everything in here is straight from what I saw. It's called Each of Us, and it has an epigraph from Science Times, which is my favorite section of the paper. The epigraph reads, "By the time it is done growing, there are about a billion billion water molecules in a typical snowflake," Dr. Liebrecht says. "And on average," he calculates, "each of us on Earth has contributed by exhalation and evaporation about 1,000 of the molecules in each snowflake." So that was one of those wonderful things to read on the morning paper and realize that you know what you're going to write your poem about that day. It's called Each of Us. "We are all here in these eyelashes of flakes zinging at our faces over and over. Our loves requited and not. The joyful young man I wrote to the year after college. And Trisha, who said, I fell in love with a Japanese woman making teeth. And the man who tried to record all the shapes of all the clouds ever, and the man who felt sentenced to life, accused of abusing a child, because killing himself would appear an admission of guilt. Here's the woman who wrote the slogan, cat bathing made easy, and the nurse who said of newborns, they're all cartilage. I see Ella like a carousel horse, impaled on her fear, lurching forward a bit, inevitably retreating. I want her to break free of whatever darkness constrains her. I see the drunk woman who called me 3 times at 1 a.m., demanding to talk to Joey in Kansas. And here's the owner of a diamond lost on the Broadway sidewalk. Here's the dad who says, smile and say pumpernickel before taking a picture. And here's the man whose eyes were so dark no one could see his pupils. There is the child who would hold his mother's earlobe if he got sleepy, and those newlyweds who fit together like notes and measures. I notice a few atoms from the man who sprayed his late wife's perfume on his pillow before he went to bed, the only way he could sleep. And the guy who wrote a poem starring the moon without the word moon in it. And Emily's friend who wrote a song, "Sorry I Did That in Your Dream." Here's the 98-year-old woman born with wrinkled hands. The doctor guessed she'd had all her troubles in a previous life. Looking back, she agreed. And a man who wanted his ashes put in a figurehead of a ship, thinking the bowsprit's the best place for traveling the ocean for the rest of time. Thousands of molecules melt on me, including saints and late grandmothers. Look up, mouth open. Take them in, a cold, wet Eucharist.
There's so many great images there, and all of these different people. When you mentioned the drunken woman calling you, I remember one night I had this call about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was a woman saying, "Bruce, come home. This is your mother, and it's okay. Come home." And I said, "I'm very sorry. The wrong number." And she said, "I recognize you, Bruce. Don't do this. Don't do it to me. Don't." I'm going on and on. So finally, I said, "Would you do something for me?" And she said, "What?" I said, I have to go to the bathroom. I'm going to hang up. Would you call me right back? hopefully he got Bruce.
Oh, hopefully, yes.
In 2017, you published the book Bloom the Rye, but the title poem had already won the 2014 New Jersey Poets Prize. Would you read that poet for us? Poem for us?
Yes, I will, gladly. Let me find it. The New Jersey Poets Prize is given out by the Journal of New Jersey Poets, which is a wonderful publication that has been kind to me over the years, based in Morris County, New Jersey. And I was so honored to get that award. Here it is, A Bloom and a Rye. God lurks in the story of stethoscope, kaleidoscope, microscope, but also in the punched ache of falling apart, accidents, insanities, plot twists, surpassing human imagination. God's in the sparrow in the convention center, the skateboard akimbo on the freeway shoulder, the perfect paw reaching out of the long, flat roadkill, and somehow the father shooting his two daughters, third wife, and self, leaving the baby son safe asleep. God is all those lost up in the God world, being nothing, stuck between the notes. I worship the grape molding in the bunch's depths, our neighbor's ruttings and fights our baby monitor picks up, the metastasis of laughter, cauterization of grief, that maroon bog shininess of ancient remains, the magnificat of dew on lady's mantle leaf, the cousin born with fetus in fetu, her twin parasiting her ovary, the first caveman to huck a rock at his chum's skull, the walk Joe took alone to spread his arm's ashes, the cruelty young boys show to turtles, the suicidality of child molesters, even pustard, that liquid dripping from the bottle when all you really want is mustard. I worship weird domestic ways to die, electrocution by love song falling in bathtub, infant decapitation by ceiling fan, while I praise ways to create, painting with menstrual blood on cave walls, Zen sand art by kitty in litter, painted toddler feet tromping on the ceiling. I worship every reason I cried this year, slow songs, missing dad, children refusing to come downstairs for their special pancakes, adoptive mother heartbroken at a son's sins. Also, every new song I loved this year, but most of all, if I may see the many years to come.
That's two poems that you've read tonight that are kind of redefining or defining God. Is this something that you're aiming for? Do you come from a strong religious background, or are you trying to develop one for yourself?
Well, I was raised at the Episcopal Church, and I am still in it, and admire it for its social justice work and the beautiful language of its liturgy. It's been a topic that I've pondered over all my life. And I like playing what if. I have one in the first book about, you know, what if God were a Labrador retriever? You know, I could picture it. I there's so much goodness and love in a dog, and what if that was God? I find all my books have poems of religious questioning in it, and also ethical questioning, because I believe that ethics and religion are very tightly tied together, or should be. So it's been definitely one of my topics.
That's interesting. The liturgy, as you mentioned, is just about the same as the Roman Catholic in which
right.
I was raised. I became it's a good 10 years ago, an Episcopalian, not because I had any trouble with the theology, but I had trouble with the official church's positions on same-sex marriage and on women clergy, and I was appalled when they entered into a lawsuit trying to block the healthcare funds for contraception, when I felt if you're really against abortion, you have to be for contraception. But I was very lucky that my Catholic parish here, and a tremendous pastor, had put together ongoing panels with the various religious leaders in the community, and the woman who was director of the local Episcopal Church, Claire Woodley, was just so terrific that I wound up taking my act to there too. She was, so the theology doesn't bother me. It's as you mentioned, it's the ethical or the social program.
Yeah.
You have the journalism and you have the nonfiction books and the poetry all in your writing history. A semantic question: do you consider yourself a writer who writes poetry among other things, or do you see yourself primarily as a poet?
Well, I don't know. I think of it as sort of 50-50. If I'm having a bad journalism day, sometimes I can take a day off or a couple hours off and write a poem and then go back to journalism refreshed. And if I'm doing an assignment that's particularly inspiring for journalism, a lot of times that'll feed into the poetry. I don't know many people who could do 8 hours a day in poetry unless you're teaching it. And I've not been interested in joining academia, so I've found that journalism as my day job, my 9-to-5 job, and poetry in all the other times has been a good mix.
Years ago, I interviewed I used to do a lot of technology writing. I had over 2,500 columns and for various papers and everything on technology. And I did interviews of people back in the early days of word processing, to what they were using. And one of the people that I interviewed was Dan Berrigan. And he used a computer for his prose. Mm-hmm. But he handwrote his poetry. He thought that made sense to the way his mind worked. Now, more and more poets are using computers too. But do you see a difference in the process, whether you write in longhand or whether you sit at the computer?
Oh, maybe it's been like 25 years in journalism that's ruined my handwriting, but I always write on the computer for poetry and for nonfiction. And actually for poetry, I am so grateful for, you know, to be alive while word processing is a thing, because I pretty much keep all my poems in one file, all my ideas to put in poems someday in another file, and all my paperwork and when it comes to submitting poems for publication in another file. And it makes it so that, especially with my pile of inspirations, the ability to search that document is so helpful, because sometimes I'll be writing an assignment, a poetry assignment. I have a friend who does anthologies, and she was doing a call for poems about donuts. And I wrote a poem about donuts, but I was able to search for donuts, the word donuts, in my file. And I searched through my file of any poem I've ever written, and there was, lo and behold, a donut in there somewhere. Not really. It was a love poem that I read at a friend's wedding, but it had a really good donut image in it, and that's the one that got chosen for the anthology. So if I had to write without that file of inspiration, I would be very hard-pressed to get anything out if I were looking at a blank piece of paper.
Okay, and the blank piece of paper at times can be scary.
I've never tried it. I have a blank screen, but that's okay, because I can look over and look at my kind of palette of what I want to put in a poem someday and see if anything catches my attention.
We have some callers on the line. I have the caller here from the 804 area code. Hello.
Hi, good evening. I'm enjoying the discussion. I'm a global visionary. I'd like to see if there's ways I can work with both of you, because I've also authored some poems. I have one that's in the President Ronald Reagan Library that Maya Angelou commented on, and I'm looking to just find the master licensor to bring it out globally in a unique way to help the people of Haiti who can't help themselves, and create more ways of thinking and doing things along those lines, having it put on like T-shirts and posters and translate into languages and go all around the world, and a percentage ongoing to help the people of Haiti through church ministries and nonprofits. And there's a whole spiritual story behind why I chose Haiti for that.
But that's congratulations. How did your poem happen to get in the Ronald Reagan Library?
He proclaimed the day back in 1983, National Care and Share Day, and I had authored this brief poem in the summer, and as soon as I saw that he had proclaimed that day, it was sort of synchronistic, so I sent it out, and it's in the President Ronald Reagan Library. It can be viewed on a blog, the word creativity, 777.com, and Maya Angelou even commented on my poem, which was thrilled at. I found her on a blog talk show. It's archived. If you put my name and Maya Angelou, bring it up, and you can hear her speaking with me and her kind words about the poem. It's only three lines long. It's titled Caring, Sharing. It reads, if you dare to care, then share. If you share, pay heed. God will reward every good deed. It sort of sums up what life should be all about. And if you contemplate it long enough, it will force you to take an action to help someone less fortunate than yourself. And when you do that, you're actually being a blessing back to yourself. That's what I want people to understand.
That's terrific.
Great.
Why don't you take my email and send it to me?
Yeah, I don't use email. If you have my number, if you can share it. I have a business partner in Bayside, too, who's assisting me now with revolutionizing global economics and more.
How can you in the 21st century not use email?
Well, again, if the grid goes down tomorrow, how are you going to function? I grew up before all these technologies came into place. I have no objection to it, except that in my case, it interferes with my creativity. I stay in a very creative mode. I have a smartphone with a web browser. I just scan the internet, and I make contact through telephone or snail mail if I have to. I can cover a lot more than any email very quickly. I can turn on a dime, and I can hear from the inflection of someone's voice just how things are going. So you can't do that with email necessarily. It has its place, but it's not for me at this point. I look at it as if I had a secretary and she would take dictation and send out the emails, because I'm looking eventually to roll out unlimited opportunities, probably burning out about 8 or 9 secretaries a day with unlimited opportunities, empowering women and indigenous people as I transform global economics, education, politics, religion, and more based on new paradigms of spirituality and unconditional agape love. I actually share common background with President Trump. I'll give you a big website that's controlled by my partner in Bayside, New York. If you simply Google my last name, Traulsen, it's spelled T like Tom, R-A-U-L-S-E-N like Nancy, and then put the word and, A-N-D, and then Trump, T-R-U-M-P, and the word whistleblower. That will bring you to a page on this big website, rootingoutcorruption.weebly.com. You'll see some interesting texts and documents. My mother was a supermodel, and she actually was asked and did pose for pictures as the Blessed Mother in Our Lady Seat of Wisdom Chapel at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. That's all documentable.
I taught at Marist. I'm going to let you go because I have another caller waiting, and I haven't get back to
you. Yeah, I'm, sure.
Thank you very much for calling in. Thank you. I see from the 917 area code, my old friend Chick Donahue, to the present book out detailing his the longest beer run ever, where it's the storyteller of Chick delivering beer as the merchant seaman to people from our old neighborhood during the Vietnam War in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And hitching around through combat zones and being caught in the Tet Offensive and doing all sorts of things that, looking back, sound very crazy. Good afternoon, Chick. Well, good evening.
Good afternoon, John. Good evening. And good evening to your guest.
Hi.
Do you have any questions for my guest or any comments?
No, I was listening since you went on at 7 o'clock, was it? And I say, why am I doing this? And it finally dawned on me why I'm, because I was never interested in poetry until I met guys like you. And my brother Bob is very interested in poetry. And I'm going to spend a week with him next month in Ireland, just him and I, walking the roads of West Ireland, two brothers, two old brothers, and both in our 70s. And he's very much interested in it. And I figured I could get a cheap education by listening to your show all of this month.
Well, is it working for you?
Yes. Yes, it is working for me. It is working for
okay.
me. I've had more poetry in the last 4 weeks than I've had in most of my life, I guess.
Tina, do you have any questions? Chick. Chick has an interesting background in that he was a high school dropout, does not have a college degree, and has a master's from Harvard, and spent most of his life as a union organizer.
Wow. Well, my grandfather was a merchant marine, and we were just down in the World War II Museum in New Orleans, and I was reading up on, you know, what their losses were during the Second World War. So my hat's off to you for your service to the country.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Back to Tina. Tina, but in addition to published books, you mentioned that your individual poems have appeared in many publications, and I noted they won some awards. Would you take us through some of your publishing highlights?
Oh, yeah. Probably the weirdest one I had was when I had a poem published on the buses of Seattle, Washington. There was a contest for short poems that could be put on a poster, and so one of mine was chosen for that. And I've been lucky enough to be published in Poetry East, Prairie Schooner, Beloit Poetry Journal, Crab Creek Review, Poetry Northwest, which I was in quite a bit in when I lived in Seattle. And the poem I read earlier on To Yahweh was in the Best American Poetry of 2009, which was a huge honor. But I'm always sending stuff out. I try to have probably 10 packets of poems out at any given time. I always expect to get rejected so that I don't get my feelings hurt. I just assume that, you know, probably a 90% failure rate is about average. Maybe other people have better luck or worse luck, but I just try to get them out there at all times, and have been aiming for some new places as well. But I think getting published is part of the landscape, and it's always a joy when you get to read with other poets. Next week I'll be we were talking before the show, I'll be at the Hudson Valley Writer Center with other poets from the latest press that published Bloom and Awry, which is Cavan Carey Press. They are a beautiful nonprofit organization that tries to get poems out into the waiting rooms of doctor's offices and requires its poets to do community service through poetry. So we're all going to be, four of us are going to be reading next Sunday. And I want to give a shout out to just how beautiful they make their books. The A Bloom and Awry copy I find very just lovely to hold, because it's got this coating on the cover that's sort of like velvet, and I'd aspired to be one of their poets for many years, and I was glad to finally come on board. So that's one of my main publishing highlights.
I actually talking about publishing, and it's I think this duotrope service, we can do an inventory and you can check different places that accept your poem. But actually, the publication of one of my poems to Chick's brother, his brother is the short story writer, and he had something accepted in a publication called Down in the Dirt, and it turns out that it's only one of the publications of an outfit called Scars TV, SCARS TV. So I looked, and they had poems, and I submitted the poem to it, and it's the one that people have been laughing about. It's the one that the Poetry Super Highway used. It's called Submission. Dear editor, the enclosed are a few poems which I sincerely hope that you will choose to publish in your fine journal. In the event that you choose not to do so, I hope that your rib goes up in flames, or your subscribers die, and that you and your staff rot in hell. Respectively submitted. And so it was published there. And they're also publishing one of my short stories.
Oh,
so
great.
I'm very happy with that. And it was all because Chick's brother, as he mentioned, is a writer.
It's a small world.
It is a small world. What's next for you?
I have another book in mind of poetry that I've always been fascinated with vocabulary words, and I want to do a book based on unusual and delicious vocabulary words. That's sort of I've never done a theme book, and I think this might be a good challenge. I'm doing a book review I hope that will be published in the Georgia Review about Patty Ann Rogers' latest book, Quickening Fields. She's my favorite living poet and a great inspiration to me, and her new book is a delight. So I'm going to be working on that. I'm doing an interview of Sam Sachs, who's a younger poet who has a new book out. That'll be for the Poetry Foundation blog. And I'm working on an article on local efforts in New Jersey to fight racism that are taken on by individual towns and counties. So that's probably due at the end of the week, and has been very engaging to talk to people all over the state of New Jersey on how they're trying to celebrate diversity and get rid of oppression on the local level.
you sound very busy. I would normally go to the Hudson Valley Writers Center, but since it's Sunday, it's good day of the radio show, and I tend never to leave the house
It's at 3 o'clock, if I recall correctly, so you might get home in time.
No, but I spend time preparing, as you probably saw today.
Hopefully,
you saw it today. We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your life. What else might you like our audience to know about Gina Kelly?
Well, I'd like to actually read a journalism poem, if I may, from A Bloom and a Rye, because
I was going to ask you for one last poem to wrap up the interview, to go right ahead.
Oh, okay. This was one that I read my last day at work at the paper. I've freelanced for them since, but I read this the last day. It was a homage to our craft, and it's actually more and more important now, almost 10 years later, than it was when I wrote it, because I'm in awe of the amount of work and the amount of dedication that goes into putting out a newspaper, and the amount of seriousness that all the journalists I've ever worked with have approached the truth with, and realize that if they aren't telling the truth, they shouldn't even be working. So I believe it's a noble profession, and long may it thrive, although lately it's been difficult with the business model and the noise from Washington to grant journalism the respect that it's due. This is called On Leaving the Newsroom. It is magic writing news. We have an honored front row seat in life, the chance to walk through the bat cave for 6 hours, seeing the last ceilings full of brown bats mysteriously dying. What a privilege to listen to someone tell of brain injury, grief, monster trucks, or false imprisonment. A gift to read the actual suicide note, hear about a beau who's the cowboy kind of quiet, watch the drips fall off Michael Phelps's perfect shoulders, hear good luck from the flood victims who need it more than we do, attend a nocturnal bird migration concert, know a little bit about just about everything, start with rumors and end with reality, swear by precision, become incapable of fibbing, ask with abandon, and take notes on talkers more profound than any of our imaginations. Then distill, discuss, dither over it, and hit send so a million can know what we learned. Here I learned Muhammad Atta's eyes looked so dark no one could see his pupils. Here I learned of the girl who would not take off her father's necktie because it smelled like him before he rushed into the burning tower. You can't buy a front row seat like that, a priceless seat, rarer and rarer. And for 20 years they paid me to sit or stand or run or sprint and use that keyboard. So few are this lucky.
You're absolutely right, and that could bring us into a whole thing. I'm a newspaper junkie, and of course, whenever I go into a place I haven't been, or even the place where I go on vacation, I buy all the local papers, and I get into them, and I find that my appreciation for the written word really came from reading Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin and all of the great columnists, and my understanding a lot of the issues, not the specific political issues of the day, but the overriding issues come from the David Brookses and the George Wills and people that go to a higher level. And I just don't know, with advertising being eaten by the internet, to what you see as the future of writing.
If I knew that, I would be a millionaire. I have faith that people will want news that is true and fact-checked and thoughtful and expensive. And I think people will continue to pay for that. There needs to be a better model. Their attempts at, you know, hyperlocal blogs and nonprofit journalism. I am hoping before the end of my lifetime that somebody richer and smarter and, you know, more versed in the business than I am will figure out how to keep journalism, which is incredibly expensive but incredibly worth it and central to the health of the republic, alive and thriving.
I argue so often with people who want to dismiss the great papers because everyone knows the New York Times, the Washington Post are liberal. Everyone knows the Wall Street Journal is conservative. So I don't read those. And try to explain that the great newspapers have a very strong line between editorial and the news. And these aren't the tabloids. This is the New York Post that,
right,
that owns Donald Trump, or the Daily News that hates Donald Trump. These are great papers, and people don't get it. I wouldn't read that, they say, because that's a liberal rag.
Right.
That's the business paper, you know. And it's sad. And then you get the White House, who is upset because of the editorial columns of the Washington Post, and they try to take it out on Amazon. There's just a complete lack of understanding.
So, well, there was such a division between the editorial and the news sides of the papers I've worked at that you would get in trouble if you were even sending internal emails that sounded opinionated about the topics you were covering, that we really were not allowed to go to demonstrations, or a lot of journalists wouldn't even vote because they didn't want to take political action in they were trying to keep themselves pure so that they couldn't be called, you know, leaning towards one or the other side unfairly.
Yeah, it's sad the way it's become, it's honestly. And then we have all the conglomerates that are trying to gobble up the radio stations and everything. And it's something that the public has to become knowledgeable of and has to be understanding,
right.
But
yeah.
I don't know if that's thing. Well, thank you very much, Tina. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
I hope all of you will bring it back next week for my interview with Richard Duffy as we conclude National Poetry. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, there's been a bunch of them this year so far, put it in a book. Tune in next Sunday, and until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And we'll go out, since we're still in April, with Campaign. Again.